I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Altafine. Rete, pareggio. Milan 1, Benfica 1. Ha pareggiato Altafine. Servizio di applausi.
George, do you think all this success is just a one-night stand, or can you settle down to a permanent life in showbiz?
I mean, it can't go on the way it has been going. But I think we may last a little longer.
Solo davanti al portiere. Respinge Costa Pereira. Rete ha segnato in questo momento Altafine. 2-1 per il Milan.
Among those who are going to Washington for President Kennedy's funeral are the Duke of Edinburgh, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, and Mr. Wilson. Family mourners and members of the United States government have been filing past the body, now lying in state in the White House.
Sangata formidabile di Mora. Costa Pereira devia assente in corner. 37esimo del secondo tempo, Milan 2, Benfica 1.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me, as always, is Jonathan Wilson. And today we have with us Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at The Independent. Miguel, pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you've gone for quite a historical game. 1963 European Cup final, played at Wembley, of course. It ended AC Milan 2, Benfica 1. Why have you gone for this game, Miguel?
Well, I wouldn't quite say I've gone for it. I'd say I was bullied into it by the host.
Yeah, you see, people say this. I'm not having any.
I wanted to do the 2010 World Cup final, as that was kind of personal to me.
Boring.
But instead, Jonathan has pushed me into something of academic and historic interest. But no, in seriousness, I did a big piece on this for the Blizzard 6.5 years ago on that final. And I think it's...
Theblizzard.co.uk.
Yeah, that's it. we always have a tendency to build up the... historical importance of the Champions League finals because of the prestige, the gravitas of the event, and obviously because, you know, the winner enters the kind of the pantheon of football greats and that sort of thing. But this was a game of really genuine, and actually at a moment, which is, I suppose, what we're really talking about, a moment of genuine historic importance of football. It's actually rare this happened so cleanly or so symbolically, but I think it was definitely the case in this match where it very much split two eras. Both in terms of the two teams that were playing and where they were in their trajectories, and also the entire way the game was played. And at the moment I'm referring to, I suppose, this was obviously the game was Benfica 1, Milan 2. Benfica, the defending champions, who were going for a third European Cup in a row. Milan, who at that point had never won a European Cup. One of them very much... archetypes of the attacking, almost kind of free-form football that reigned in the 50s and going into the 60s. and Milan very much the not the first Catenaccio side, but the first truly a continentally successful Catenaccio side, with the game ultimately coming down to a foul in the 60th minute from Pivitelli on Mario Coluna, the Benfica playmaker, put him out of the game. And again, given everything Catenaccio represented, given the way the game developed, and given that was a turning point, yeah, it was such a cleanly representative moment.
Would you go as far to say it was there was a bit of innocence lost in football in this game? We talk about Catenaccio, so talk about the foul, which we'll come on to in the second half when we talk about the game. But what Miguel's saying there is, you know, he's attacking football in the 50s and 60s, Jonathan, blah, 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 and then this sort of newish sort of style is ushered in.
Innocence is an awkward word.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Given that the Benfica coach was Fernando Vieira, yes, who had been coach of Chile a year earlier at the Battle of Santiago, where there wasn't a lot of innocence in that game. But it, from a tactical point of view, I think it's the beginning of a period of rapid change of tactics. So you'd had a way of playing and that had existed from sort of the 1870s through to maybe early 1880s, depending exactly when you chart the beginning of 2-3-5 from, to the change in the offside law 925. And post that, essentially everybody's played roughly the same way. And there's variations on it, but everybody's played the sort of a vague WM. And, you know, depending where you come from and depending how you see the game, you might play a centre-half as a very sort of defensive man-marking figure as he was in England, or he might be a more creative playmaking deep-lying midfield as he was in Central Europe. But this is when you get this, you know, as Miguel says, it's this clash between that free form, let's score more than the opposition, that you'd had with the Real Madrid of the late 50s, that you had with Benfica of Bella Gutmann.
Benfica's previous final was probably the ultimate game of that day, because it was 5-3 Benfica against Real Madrid.
Yeah, which we did in an earlier podcast, yeah. So I mean, do look that up.
Yes.
No, but I mean, we talk a lot about Gutmann, who we're going to keep referring to here. We're obviously not going to go into the Gutmann backstory, but if you want to know about Gutmann, go back to that podcast, which is one of the early ones we did.
I believe you got a book out as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to talk about the names that long ago, but it is still available.
Uh-huh.
Remarkably, it hasn't sold out yet. This is the beginning. I mean, not the Catenaccio of Inter. Inter's Catenaccio, yeah, I think, was much, much more defensive and much more cynical form of football. Although, as you say, the tackle or the foul was pivotal.
Yeah. Pivotal Pivitelli,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, within sort of 5 years of Catenaccio, you get the beginnings of total football, which ultimately supplants that. And you can say even Celtic played a variant of that when they beat Inter in 67. And then you get the reaction against total football. So this beginning of these cycles that we expect and understand now, this is the first time it really kicks into action. This is the beginning of that era when tactics are evolving constantly. And of course, one of the reasons for that is, unless you're seeing how other people play the game, unless you're coming up against them, which is what the European Cup allows you to do on a regular basis, then you're never going to evolve.
Yeah.
Or the evolution is going to be much slower, because you need to be playing against a different system. Well, hang on, what are they doing? How do we counter that? How do we make what we're doing better?
Yeah.
And so this is the beginning of that churn that we're now familiar with.
In that sense, it was probably when the European Cup to become the Champions League kind of actually took off an event in the modern guise as well, wasn't it? Given there was a kind of innocence about it. And of course, aggression had always existed in the game, but it was just kind of more naked aggression. Whereas what was so different about this was just how calculated it felt and how it fit Milan's overall game plan, which is ultimately, I mean, Nerio Rocco, who, you know, of course, one of the principal figures of Catenaccio, he pretty much talks in one of his pre-match press conferences and in subsequent analysis about the game about how we invoke the right of the weak, which is basically we're playing a superior team. So
which is a phrase that Lev Filatov, the great Russian writer, it coined when Krylia Sovyatov started playing with a sweeper, playing, you know, a sort of proto-Catenaccio sort of back in the early 50s. But that idea that... And this idea of weakness, which might seem very odd to us, but you read Gianni Brera, the sort of great, the greatest of Italian journalists of the era, some pretty questionable views on certain things, but as a football writer, somebody who sort of formed the vocabulary and the sort of the way the football was conceived of in Italy, and he had this idea that Italians were physically weak, and that because of that, they had to be cleverer in the worst sense of the word, clever than their opponents. Mm-hmm. They had to be cunning. And that endured in Italian football right through till Sacchi.
But they've got funny little quirks, because I think in England we were unaware that Italy had a bit of a thing about playing England, didn't they? You know, especially in England, and they felt...
Well, I think that those two things go together, that... that
Italy
had won the World Cup in 34 and 38.
Yeah.
In pretty questionable circumstances in both
yes,
times.
And
certainly no sense of physical weakness then. Mm. But in 48, England go to Turin, and Italy are double world champions, and England haven't been at the World Cup in 34 and 38, or 30 for that matter. And they haven't had the disaster of 1950 by that point yet.
Yeah.
And England go to Turin, and they batter Italy 4-0. And physically... they absolutely destroy them. Mm. And it's a great England team. You know, it's the England of Matthews and Finney on the wings. You've got Mannion, you've got Mortensen, you've got...
too early for Loftus, would it?
Lawton, I think, was a centre forward.
Okay.
So it's you know, a great front five. And they hammer Italy 4-0 on their own soil. And that, I think, sort of contributed to this sense that... Mm. In Italy, of yeah, we're physically not able to cope, and you know, it's only when Sacchi comes along and says no,
yeah,
Sacchi, you know, is a shoe salesman, is going over Europe, and hang on, we're no different to everybody else.
Yeah.
What is this idea?
And that's even more interesting in the kind of financial historical context of the game. Given right, it was certainly in a financial sense, it was much more innocent to today, but Serie A was probably the first truly European. Mm. Kind of glamour league in that sense, given in the 60s it benefited from a load of Italian industrialists investing in football, particularly in Juventus. And, you know, there was the famous, the Lure de Lira, where basically it was the first European league that was starting to collect.
Yeah, I mean, Real Madrid had done it, but as a league as a whole.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And even so the year before, I mean, one of the reasons Rocco almost came up with this, well, not one of the reasons, but I suppose one of the chains that led to this system in the game, and it's much more defensive approach, was that he had two of the most expensive forwards in the world in Altafini and Greaves, and didn't know how to get them to work together, and often castigated them because they don't play as a part of a system.
But he didn't like Greaves, though, did he?
No, you eventually just had to get rid of him. And
he brought in Dino Sarni, the Brazilian, who's sort of a little bit deeper lying.
Yeah.
And you gave him a better structure.
Well, that's a classic case as well, isn't it, of a move that superficially seems more defensive, and that essentially bring on a midfielder for
but
an attacker.
But makes him better from attacking body.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because they were quite free scoring, that Milan.
Well, they in 61-2, when they won the title, they scored 83 goals in 34 games.
Yeah.
So that's neat. Yeah.
Different to Capello's Milan that season, wasn't it?
Sorry?
Different to Capello's Milan when they scored.
Yeah. But, I mean, but just to go on that, I mean, and I think this is what is so, again, what so sums this up. In the era before this game, if you take World Cup, say, the average goal scored at a World Cup were 3.6 per game. Within 10 years, only three years after this final, by the 66 World Cup, again, culminating at Wembley, just like this match, it had dropped to 2.6. So ultimately...
Which is where we are now, roughly, isn't it?
Although it's starting to rise again, and I think we should come on to this at the end, because Jonathan was talking about the kind of response and counter-response to tactical trends, whereas I think the last few years, the first time this has been broken in terms of it's no longer attack-defence.
Well, I've got thoughts on that, so when we get to that, we'll talk about that. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
there'll be some in-depth tactical discussion coming up later.
Damn right there will be. Milan's road to the final included wins over Union Luxembourg, hammered them, Ipswich Town, Galatasaray, and Bob Shankly's Dundee. Pleasing to see
in the days
him.
When Bob was the more successful of the Shankly brothers. But he was. I mean,
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But it was just quite enjoyable to see Dundee playing against the mighty Milan. Obviously, if it's a different competition.
That's a classic trivia answer, that as well.
It is. Absolutely. And as you say, Benfica, they'd won the previous two competitions. You know, they were looking good, but Gutman had left the club.
Yeah,
And cursed them. Let's not forget that.
And then the curse still remains, apparently.
Well, I think there is a point you made in that run, in that as quaint as it seems now, and anyone looking at that from a modern perspective will go, you shouldn't be European champions after a run like that. But of course, European football was constructed so differently, in that, you know, the champions of country could actually keep their teams together much longer. Mm-hmm. There were so many more regulations and restrictions, which meant you just couldn't build super clubs in the same way, which is why even Milan, and particularly Real Madrid before that, seemed, in terms of the personnel in their squad, relatively exotic compared to most of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, you talk about a run like that, they've beaten the champions of two countries who provide European champions for all decades out. And equally, Benfica's run, okay, they get a bye in the first round as champions, beat Norrköping, Dukla Prague, but then they have to beat Feyenoord.
Yeah.
And again, by the end of a decade, Feyenoord are European champions. So, okay, Ipswich and Dundee, they're not, even in those days, they weren't giants in their own countries. But they were the champions of good leagues and therefore were good teams.
And unknown quantities as well. I mean, I know you, to compare nowadays to back then is almost a bit pointless, really.
Was Ramsey still manager of Ipswich or had he gone to England by then?
He left in the March, so yeah, you would still be manager.
Yeah, yeah. So he's obviously left once the European Cup campaign.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But if you think about, you know, nowadays, you know, the financial differences between the Real Madrids and the Barcelonas compared to all the other ones. I mean, yes, people were investing in Italian football, but still, though, you know, you've got to put it in context and so. And it's still any road to any final back then, it's got to be respected.
And of course, what we overlook, and I suppose something, a tragedy like the Munich air disaster makes so stark, is just how almost daunting the very act of kind of going to another country to something you weren't too familiar with, and even air travel was at that point
A trip to Galatasaray, I mean, when they say, oh, it's a long trip, it bloody well was back then.
And this was an era when the away goal didn't exist. So, I mean, and part of that was because, part of the reason why it was introduced was because clubs would go to foreign countries that they didn't know too well. And the natural inclination when you don't know a team is we'll sit tight and kind of conserve and just bring them home and then see what we can get there.
Yeah, completely. All right, gentlemen, let's have a quick break. And after which, we'll talk about the game itself. See you in a moment.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Conclusione altissima. Ma ripetiamo, il Milan ha vinto l'ottava edizione della Coppa dei Campioni.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right, gentlemen. So we go to Wembley for the actual match.
A 3 p.m. kickoff.
Lovely at that.
On a Wednesday.
I know.
And still 45,000 turned up.
I know. But it's quite odd to see empty seats, but then, of course, but away fans, the away faithful might not have been in huge numbers due to.
When I was researching this, I remember reading a lot of the kind of reports from the 60s and the time, and even some of the later reports in the 80s and 90s, kind of retrospectives in the game. And there was a lot of kind of dodgy sentiments about Italian waiters taking time off work to go. There was a lot of that.
When looking at these two sides, I mean, Benfica, the sort of stand-up player, obviously Eusebio, in terms of the history of football and big names. But the Milan side, you've got Giovanni Trapattoni and Cesare Maldini. When you talk about all these various tactics that are going on and evolving, you know, it's not a huge surprise that, that those two go on to manage the Italian national side.
I made this point in the piece, actually, and it's quite interesting that even though Herrera is probably is the more historically renowned manager, more associated with Catenaccio, and if you, I suppose if you count up trophies, more successful, although the relative success is different, a lot of his actual managerial proteges failed completely, whereas Rocco's actually succeeded. So as you say, you've got two there who went on to manage Italy. Trapattoni went on to be one of the best coaches of all time. And also that's right, the fact that Rocco so trusted these players that he described them as those two and Rivera, the playmaker, were his internal commission. And like, there was that moment on the pitch at Wembley where at one point where Benfica were completely overrunning them and Rocco was trying to issue tactical instructions. But even though there was only 47,000 there at Wembley that day, they couldn't hear Rocco from the pitch. but I think they eventually worked out.
Maldini said Trapattoni to Mark Colina, because Victor Benitez, the Peruvian, was getting overrun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He stuck trap on Eusebio. But that was. I mean, it was probably
on Eusebio or on Colina. Anyway,
it was Eusebio. It was Pivitelli on Colina. Although interestingly, I suppose we'll get to
it. And Pivitelli was only picked.
Yeah.
Barisson, who'd scored six goals
on the run,
cutting in from the left, was dropped for Pivitelli, a specific tactic to man Mark Colina.
Which again is actually quite historically atypical at that point, isn't it? I mean, something so nakedly defensive to...
Well, at a time when there's no substitutes.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't sort of, if it's not going right, you can't pull something off at half time and change it.
I mean, the whole no substitutes thing, I know it's a bit of a obvious thing to say.
It seems mental now.
Yeah. Absolutely. I know there's some rule changes thing. All challenges were a bit stronger back then. I can't believe that wasn't a red card and so on. But the no subs thing, I find it.
Especially when you're allowed subs in friendlies.
Yeah. Mm.
You're allowed subs before half time in friendlies for injury.
Yeah. I mean,
So when Hungary beat England 6-3 at Wembley in 1953, the keeper gets subbed with 10 minutes to go. Grosic goes, and mainly I suspect because Grosic was such a sort of worrier, he was just scared he was going to make some terrible mistakes and let England back in the game.
The man you've described to me as so full of nonsense, it was
Grosic. Grosic was a great keeper. He was a very, very brave man who did great things in 56 in the uprising. He had some interesting ideas about medicine. He used to wear a red bandana in training because he thought it warded off brain disease. Right. I don't think there's any medical science behind that.
Okay. Yeah. Is there any writings about this man, Jonathan? If only there were. But back to Wembley, of course. So the game begins itself. And who would have been the favourites at
Benfica
this point? It would have been Benfica. Yeah. The holders.
They're going for a third-year Brain Cup. Even the previous season has been such a kind of a passing of the torch in so many ways, and that they really beat Madrid quite well. And in a classic game of the era, they go 3-0 up, Madrid come back to 3-0, and they still win 5-3.
Madrid have been 2-0 up.
Yes, that was it. Yeah. Uh-huh. My apologies.
That's all right, don't worry.
I've been so invested in this game. And at the end of that game, there's the moment where Di Stefano gives Eusebio his shirt.
I think it's Puskás gives him his shirt.
No, I think it was Di Stefano.
It was one of the greats. One of the greats.
Anyway, in my piece in the Blizzard.
Anyway, it was one of the greats. Gave Eusebio his shirt.
And that scene is a passing of the torch and all that. And everyone expects Benfica to go on and win three in a row and get that gold standard feat.
But of course, Gutmann had gone by then. But
there's a story. I think you see some of Rocco's genius.
Yes.
Not just for tactical affairs, but for man management as well. That as the bus pulls into the car park, he at Wembley, he sees his players looking apprehensive and says, like, anybody who's scared, don't even bother getting off a coach.
Yeah,
and then a very sort of serious, stern man then sort of apes being absolutely terrified, just clinging to his seat, and that sort of breaks the tension. And I think there was apprehension because this was a not just Eusebio and Colina, but José Torres was a
phenomenal side.
Yeah, a 6'3" centre forward who could actually play football as well.
Yeah,
well, Gutmann's stamp was still on this side.
Yeah,
they
and Riera wasn't exactly kind of
no Exactly. And it's incredible to think that, Milan, obviously Real Madrid have won by far the most European Cups and Champions Leagues, but Milan, I believe, are second on that list.
Yeah, yeah.
And to think that in 63 was their first one, you know, quite a momentous occasion for them.
And again, like, it's one of those things that's almost impossible to imagine now, but because the European Cup and coverage of it, there were such isolated fixtures and coverage was so rare that any sort of big events or big made such a huge impression on the kind of general psychology, which I suppose is why the 1960 final has such a kind of a, you know, has a marked effect on people like Sir Alex Ferguson, Hugh McIlvany and the like. And it's similar with this. It's a team that wins two in a row and has dethroned Madrid, just in the kind of the aura that involves alone.
Well, and the fact that they'd beaten Barcelona in the first final, who were the only other team at that point to have beaten Real Madrid in the European Cup.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're the Madrid Slayers, and then the Slayers are the Madrid Slayers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but yeah, Benfica. It's easy now maybe it's difficult now to appreciate just what a huge force they appeared at the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And of course, they score the first goal of the game, and it's Eusebio.
Set up by Coluna. Well, Coluna plays the first pass.
He's involved. Torres flicks it on.
But Eusebio just burst through.
A classic Eusebio goal.
Smashes it in the corner.
Quicker, stronger, great shot. Flies in off a post.
And if you're a Milan player and you see that happen, you must be quite demoralised, thinking, oh, blimey, here we go,
yeah.
Yeah, because it was, as you say, Jonathan, classic Eusebio, such power and sort of pace and skill and so on.
And it's one of those situations as well that seems kind of, it seems set up to emphasise the difference between the two. And one of those differences was considered, you know, Eusebio, probably the greatest player in the world at that point, well, bar Pelé, who actually, it was in that year as well, that they played, Benfica played Santos in the Intercontinental Cup, and actually, to be fair, Santos battered them and Pele nutmegged Eusebio.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. So it was
would have been late in 62 that game.
Yeah. So it was
that Santos team. Like, I'd been a little bit of a Pele skeptic, and then I saw. I think it's 62 Libertadores final when they beat Boca, and Jesus, Pele's brilliant. Okay. Yeah. He gets an absolute battering. Uh-huh. And just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
So you rate Pele?
Like, he's up there.
Yeah. Better than Zidane?
Yes.
Let's not start that again.
Better than Kevin Jones.
But yeah, so Eusebio is certainly the best striker in Europe. Then at the other end, you have this, from everything you read about him, or certainly up in this final, you have Altafini, who almost seems like a Higuain figure. Who has this great goal-scoring record, and yet is considered a bottler. And hence, someone we've already discussed it today, Brera. Brera had that famous, Brera had nicknames for so many players, or both endearing and cutting. And this is a classic in which he called him Conaleone, which is basically a mix between a rabbit and a lion, the fear of a rabbit with the bravery of a lion, because he was a player that could, was so confounding in that way. And early on in the game, he misses a chance, of course, in almost a classic Higuain way.
Yeah, well, Altafini missed, he scores, obviously, equalised on 58 minutes, but he'd missed about four chances.
Yeah, there was one big one early on.
Yeah,
and I think I remember from looking at even his reaction, you could tell like it just felt like one of those moments. It's going to be one of those days, and where the difference in class will be emphasised. On one hand, you have the most brutal finisher of all time, maybe in Eusebio, and then on the other side, this Higuain character. They harsh Higuain, but it's impossible not to go for
that. A player who misses big chances on big occasions.
Yeah.
It's a shame for Higuain, because he was a great centre forward. But I take the point you're saying. So we get into half time and it's 1-0 to Benfica. And, Rocco at half time is obviously the cogs are turning. Did they sort of go out differently for the second half, Milan?
Well, they did actually start quite, maybe more attacking. And I suppose this is the thing. We're looking at this with, with hindsight, and where you expect it to completely conform to all the tropes of Catenaccio. Whereas, as Jonathan's already said, it wasn't. It was a bit more, a little bit more open-ended.
Football generally is in flux at this point. Yeah. I mean, pressing, which is the big development. I reckon you could, taking away all sort of differences in television coverage, you could show somebody a game from before roughly 1965 or after, and something you would know which it was. Without knowing who the teams were, without knowing who the players were, just the way the game is played. And that's because of pressing. Pressing comes in the mid-60s. One of the reasons England win the World Cup, you obviously have Ajax, you have Dynamo Kiev. That's the difference between old football and modern football. And this is sort of, you know, Catenaccio is sort of the beginnings of that.
Yeah.
It's conceiving of the team as a system as a whole. Yeah. And it's saying we don't have to match man for man. We can create a structure which will, you know, which will be able to outmatch their structure, even if individually we would lose a series of individual battles. So it's that's what modernity in football is. It's that acceptance of football, not as 11 individuals, but as a structure with 11 components.
Yeah.
And that's what you begin to see. But as you say, it's quite a slow and erratic process. So you have a game I'm always sort of amazed by is the cup final when Liverpool beat Leeds in 64.
Mm. Yeah.
Which Liverpool win quite comfortably 2-1 in extra time. And you watch it with modern eyes and you think it's a normal game of football. It's average. Yeah, it's not particularly exciting. It's not particularly defensive. You read the press coverage of it, and they're all appalled. Peter Wilson, no relation, in the Mirror, their big sort of football columnist of the era. So he says something along the lines of, it was 64.
Are you sure? Because Liverpool's first time. Oh, yeah, because they'd won the league the year before.
They won the league in 64 this year. So it's 65, 65 cup final. And Peter Wilson says, we're told this is the kind of football that will win us the World Cup next year. If that is true, I want no part of it.
Super.
And yet, to modernise, it just looks like a normal game.
Yeah. With the start of the World Cup, as you said earlier on.
Yeah. In the space of 10 years, that's a huge drop.
It is.
Now we consider it like the recent spike at about 0.5 is marked.
Well, we've seen a significant upshift in the Champions League from 2008.
Yeah.
So I think Champions League group stages, Champions League begins in 94.
Mm.
So between 94 and 2008, I think there's only two occasions when there were more than three goals per game in knockouts.
Yeah.
Since 2008, there's been only one occasion when there hasn't been more than three goals per game. So I think the sea change you see in the early 60s has sort of been mirrored in the late first decade of the 21st century.
Yeah. Just a point of pedantry, it was Di Stefano who gave
it. Okay, you were right. Well done. Well done.
It's the best to. Milan were maybe more open than expected, or not than expected, than you would think from what we modernised that point. But there was kind of the precursor to everything that happened in the 29th minute. So actually on the half hour with the key moments coming in the hour, which is when Trapattoni leaves Eusebio limping, which is kind of the first real sign that Milan are going to dig in a bit and be obstructive in that sense.
Which is why, again, I go back to that rule about the substitutes, how daft it was.
Because it just encouraged you to take out the opposition. Indeed. But people didn't do it because, that wasn't how the game was played.
Gentleman's game, etc.
And if you dish it out, you might get it back.
Well, that is true.
It might end. So one of the things that you see with a discussion over the legalisation of professionalism in 1885, there's a whole load of people saying, no, because it'll make winning too important. And the counter-argument to it, which turns out to be correct, is no, if people are relying on this game for their if it's their job, they're not going to go out and injure people, because if they get injured themselves, their career's over and they've lost their livelihood.
Yeah.
So I guess that code of honour of not being too... I mean, obviously there were brutal games before this, but the idea of taking out the opposition player didn't happen, because if you all did it, you wouldn't have a job anymore.
With specific examples like this one, though, if there's quite clearly, obviously, a player...
Yeah, no, but I think this is the beginning of that much more cynical...
Right, okay.
I think that sort of code that existed from the mid-1880s has just about prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you've got games like the Battle of Highbury in 1934, kind of things do spill over. But
that's kind of a more just an emotional aggression.
It's not a targeted...
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the moment that we're sort of alluding to here, Altafine equalised in 58, as we mentioned.
Yeah, okay, so after missing his four chances, and one of them where he's basically... Bruno Mora, the winger, is kind of remonstrating with him and like giving out to him for missing a chance, he equalises. But I suppose that's not a true turning point, because Benfica ultimately so used to these. That was football at the time.
Yeah.
Because it was so high scoring, there were so many of these swings and matches in a way that Wenger's always gone on about how the first goal matters so much because it dictates and conditions the entire game. And this is almost a match that first kind of conditions that, or first kind of sets this in place and leaves football as is for what? In terms of its goal return for 50, 60 years, as we've just spoken about, in terms of 2008.
Mm.
But the true turning point then happens two minutes after that, when Benfica on the attack again. Kaluna is just about to break clear and he's just about to set up a 3-on-2. So we're expecting to go ahead. And Pivotelli, the actual foul almost seems innocuous, but it's hard not to take it. Looking at it, it doesn't look like it's just a delayed challenge or a late tackle. There's a bit more.
It's very late.
The
ball's nowhere near.
Yeah, yeah.
And it ends up breaking a bone in his foot. And then there's the famous television. Broadcast 24 years later.
That's actually one of the things they need to bring back. Is it because the concept is brilliant? So yeah, on Italian television they used to do this a lot, where they get a few figures in from a key game and sit there watching the game and get them discussing
it. It's Gary Neville's soccer box, but better.
And with arguments.
A bit no holds barred.
And there is that moment on the...
So they have Cesare Maldini and Mario Kaluna.
Yeah.
And Maldini going, no, this is nothing planned.
And there's actually an interesting thing there as well, that for years, Kaluna was... Maybe it's because of Trapattoni's fame, but for years he was convinced that Trapattoni committed the foul.
Yeah.
And years after that, he was complaining in an interview. I think it's in Ben Littleton's book, where Trapattoni was meant to come on this TV show and he refused like a coward or saying all these sort of things. But of course, it wasn't Trap.
Pivotelli.
But Kaluna on that TV show is basically saying, how on earth can you say
He's saying, look where the ball is. It's not a challenge for the ball. It's a challenge to kick me on the foot.
Did he manage to convince Maldini? I've not seen the footage or... it's unlikely.
I don't think they ever come around. Yeah, I think they Maldini's...
I don't think
quite...
reconciliation is one of the points of these shows.
and that's where I think it should be. But I think, you know, you should have an audience vote at the end or something like that. You know,
it should Jerry be brought... Springer to give his, give his verdict.
Get Springer on to for his final thought, you know. I thought it was a foul. You know?
What would you think about defensive football?
Sorry?
What would you think about the cynical defense of football?
Well, Jerry Springer?
Yeah.
Oh, Gordon Bennett, I think he likes more open out attack, doesn't he?
Well, I'd like to see Pivotelli with a lie detector.
I would as well.
I'd really like to see Roy Keane with a lie detector.
Yeah.
The lie detector would probably explode. So the foul is committed, it changes the game.
Yeah, Kaluna essentially can. And this is where it comes down. And it's incredible to think about it now, that just because of one foul, it basically completely lopsides a game as big as this. One team is playing with 10 players. Kaluna comes back on 10 minutes from the end, but can't do anything.
Yeah.
And just the momentum just swings to Milan. There's more...
But it's still a bit of back and forth.
There is. I mean, Benfica are still a good enough side. They still have chances. But there's just... Essentially, one side is... The shape and space of the game has changed with that hole on the pitch. And one side is more versed in shutting it out and the other isn't. I mean, and that's kind of what this comes down to as well. It's also...
Kaluna was so important to how Benfica played. Yeah. One of the things with Eusebio's arrival in the Benfica side, it's not just that he's a great player.
Yeah.
It allows Kaluna to... Gutman moves Kaluna deeper and Kaluna then begins creating the play from a left half position.
Yeah. Because he changed his position, didn't he, once Eusebio came?
Yeah, he dropped a lot deeper. Yeah, from being an inside forward, he becomes a wing half.
Yeah, and it's almost one of those classic Gerard Owen things, where basically a lot of Benfica's goals are Kaluna playing through walls for Eusebio to run onto.
Mm. Yeah, or knocking it long to Torres, which is how the goal comes in.
Yeah.
Or maybe long, knocking it direct to Torres.
Yeah, so immediately you're removing their main outlet. I mean, it's not quite... removing Messi from Barcelona. I'm trying to think of maybe taking a Riquelme out of his team.
PLO back in the day.
The centrepiece of how they construct attacks is just gone.
Yeah.
And they're even more freeform without direction.
Take McTominay out of United.
Casemiro out of Sunderland back in the day, perhaps.
Yeah.
Although he would usually take himself out. But anyway, Altafini scores the win.
Yeah, and which still involves a miss.
Yeah, he gets to miss the chance and then gets another goal.
Yeah.
So he's clean sweep. I mean, you see sort of the collapse of Benfica's organisation.
Yeah.
It's almost like the Torres goal for Chelsea against Barcelona. He's just in the half by himself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Except this is midway through the second half, the game is 1-1.
And it's 1-1. Yeah, it's incredible. And I suppose...
But doesn't that show the attacking... They're not thinking, okay, hang on, let's just contain. They're going forward. They're going.
I think that's a generous interpretation. I think it just shows they've lost it.
Exactly. And it's a very interesting way you see this so often in big games, and even from kind of proven champions, where there's a moment of such momentousness that it just almost like psychologically scrambles these teams. And even though a game, stand back from it, it's like it remains even. It's still there to be kind of taken in a composed manner. And they just they've gone with abandon. As you say, they've kind of they've lost all shape of themselves, a sense of themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, Aldafini runs through, Costa Pereira makes the save, but it comes back to Aldafini who sticks it in.
Yeah.
And his celebration is such a kind of...
Almost apologetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a stanza with his arms slightly spread. Kind of.
He wasn't used to this situation.
What a wild with me.
I haven't missed. Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, interesting little thing about Aldafini as well, wasn't he? He originally called Matsula.
Yes.
Because of his...
Yeah, because he was Brazilian, came over, took the name Matsula after the great Matsula.
Yeah.
And then went back to being Aldafini.
When Matsula's son came true, who was, of course, a member of the Inter team that succeeded this Milan.
There you are, I see. So Milan, they win their first European Cup, and Benfica have yet to win a major European trophy ever since.
Yeah. I mean, whatever about the historic importance for Benfica, which is huge. I mean, they did still stay a force for a decade. They got to another two European Cup finals.
Mm-hmm.
They got one in 68, obviously, against United.
Yeah, Otto Gloria comes back. Otto Gloria has sort of led the professionalisation of Benfica in the 50s, which Gutmann then really benefits from Gloria's work. Gloria comes back and he took Portugal to the semi-final of the World Cup.
Yeah.
In 66, and then he becomes Benfica coach and takes Benfica to the European Cup final at Wembley. The Gutmann curse has really kicked in by this point.
but more significantly, or more generally for the game, it completely shifts the balance of power. And the consequences are very direct. I mean, Milan, having, as you say, they hadn't won a European Cup up to that point. Then the city itself wins four of the next seven. Inter go on to win the next two. And then lose the final in 67 with Milan winning again in 69 in a game that kind of brought interest, precipitated total football, or its rise, should I say. What happened with Milan was so direct because Herrera, who'd actually, when his Barcelona beat Real Madrid in 1960 and when they played in the 1961 European Cup final, they were almost like similar to, that Real Madrid at Benfica, they were such an open team. They scored so many goals. And Herrera's Barcelona team, the one that won the title in 58 and 59, they were setting records that lasted for years in terms of how many they scored.
But I mean, he was still a very cynical, pragmatic. Although he was playing attacking football, he was a cynical, pragmatic man. There's all kinds of rumours about medication they're taking.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's another extension of what Catenaccio almost symbolised.
It's a win at all cost mentality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's it. And after seeing what Milan did and under huge pressure from Marotti, given how much Inter themselves had spent, the very next season, it was that season, wasn't it?
So it was 61 when Herrera,
It was 62, wasn't it November 62, 63, where he basically decided, they're on a bad run, he decides, not leave, we're going to change, we have to change.
No, but I mean, Herrera comes into it.
Oh, yeah, but that's it. And initially he tried a more attacking approach in 62, 63, when Milan is champions, Inter still ailing. I think it's November of that year he decides to completely rip everything up and regularly bring in the Langa.
So Catenaccio, we understand it's Catenaccio.
Yeah, and then they dominate European football and condition European football for the next... And even though, I think as you said earlier, total football supplants it, just Catenaccio, it ultimately stayed for 60 years. This basically set defensive football.
Yeah.
It came to kind of just define... The other side of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's that idea we were talking about before of sort of these cycles that you go through. I mean, we could talk about this forever, but let's try and keep it to 3 minutes or so. Total football is, I wouldn't say it's supplanted, but it faces a challenge in Il Gioco all'Italiana, an updated version of Catenaccio, which is then eventually supplanted by Sacchi's pressing and the sort of the reinvention of total football with Cruyff in the early 90s. But see, I don't think it's as simple as attacking defensive.
No, but I think
it's a proactive reactive.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening now is really interesting in that those terms almost they don't mean what they think we mean. So you can see in the last decade that the heavy possession football of what we called at the time tiki-taka, I think we're now aware there's connotations of that term that we maybe don't want, or Guardiola would rather we didn't use. But that heavy possession style of Barca and Spain, although they were subtly different from each other, has sort of been surpassed by the very dynamic transition heavy football of Klopp.
Which Guardiola's himself incorporated.
Which is but you'd historically you'd always think possession football is proactive, and that's Van Gaal's idea. If you have a ball, you're proactive.
Yeah.
And you see the sterility of his Manchester United, despite having the ball. And so you can argue Klopp's football is reactive.
Yeah. Well, gegenpressing, it's the word is inherently reactive.
And yet it feels like the most proactive because you're going hunting the ball, which is a proactive act. So it's almost like football has moved ahead of our capacity to describe it.
Yeah.
Our vocabulary no longer is adequate for describing it. And so these cycles of proactivity and reactivity that you see, well, everything's proactive and everything's reactive now. It's a much more complex picture these days.
Well, I mean, I think it's... the sort of traditional defending that ultimately has been defined first by Catenaccio, can it even exist in the modern game?
It does to the extent that 67 games last season, one team had 30% or less of the ball, but it doesn't seem to be effective.
Yeah.
I think because the attacking plans are so good and because players are so physically well-conditioned. But anyway, that's a discussion for...
Another pod.
Another game.
And indeed. Miguel. Pleasure having you on the pod, and a fascinating one to unpack indeed. Of course, for more stories like that, do go to theblizzard.co.uk.
The Independent.
Indeed. That's where you'll find
it. Their website's awful, I wouldn't bother.
Absolutely. But Miguel, a pleasure having you on Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Jonathan, pleasure as always. We're back next week. Thank you very much, everybody. See you then.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.